Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present political analyst Riad Jarrar, who discusses growing concern among the Iraqi people that Washington won't adhere to the December 31st deadline for the withdrawal of all U.S. troops. Daryl Malik Wiley, the Sierra Club's environmental justice organizer working in Louisiana, who discusses the ongoing destructive effects of last year's British petroleum oil spill, the worst in U.S. history. And Antonia Yuhas, author of the new book titled Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill, who talks about the economic and political power of the oil industry to weaken regulations on drilling safety. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
With the April 11th arrest of defeated President Laurent Gbagbo, Ivory Coast's transition to democracy looks brighter, but by no means certain. France and the European Union stepped in with an infusion of funds to support elected President Alassane Ouattara, whose militia groups, with French military support, overwhelm forces loyal to Gbagbo. Regional observers hope the new government will now be able to stabilize the West African country and remove international trade sanctions. But a new conflict is on the horizon of the world's largest exporter of cocoa. The militia groups controlled by six warlords who fought on behalf of Ouattara against former President Gbagbo have now begun to turn on each other. Open conflict has broken out between two militia leaders, Ibrahim Koulibaly and Defense Minister Guillaume Soro, who also serves as the new government's prime minister. President Ouattara is now trying to prevent another devastating war from erupting, just as his nation is attempting to recover from the conflict that just ended. A major battle over labor rights is taking place in Mexico, where the national government is debating reform of the country's progressive labor law. The changes sought by Mexico's longtime ruling party, the PRI, the Party of the Institutionalized Revolution that now controls Congress, would make it much easier for employers to fire workers and increase the workload on employees. The neoliberal reform, long sought by the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, would end the 40-hour work week and weaken the existing minimum wage law. Labor reform is the third leg of free market reform in Mexico, which follows financial reforms and educational reforms, which led to privatizing the public pension system. In 2009, President Felipe Calderón from the conservative PAN party dissolved Mexico's oldest trade union, the Mexican Electrical Workers, when the government sold off the state-owned power and light company, Utility. Neoliberal policies in Mexico have led to massive increases in economic inequality, where the 10 richest people now control over 10% of the economy. Meanwhile, over 53 million Mexicans are mired in poverty. Massive labor protests and educational campaigns across Mexico in recent weeks have succeeded, for the time being, in delaying a congressional vote on the proposed federal labor reform bill until this fall. On the gritty west side of Chicago, the city has built a new state-of-the-art high school. But the $63 million school was built near abandoned toxic industrial buildings. During the construction, the project invested $3 million to protect students from contaminated groundwater, the legacy of an old soybean processing plant. A nearby elementary school has also had to contend with industrial fumes from area factories. According to E! The Environmental magazine, cities across the country are building new schools on former toxic or brownfield sites. Green activists and parents groups are pushing for more disclosure of past toxic pollution and stricter maintenance of schools built on formerly polluted land. Tufts University urban planning professor Justin Hollander says children's developing bodies are particularly more vulnerable to toxic pollution than are adults. Illinois is one of the few states to require an environmental audit of potential school construction sites. Rhode Island Legal Services in a 2006 study found 20 states had no laws requiring school districts to investigate the possible contamination of school buildings or the need to disclose this information to the public. Lois Gibbs, who led the fight to clean up the notorious Love Canal site in upstate New York, is now urging the Environmental Protection Agency to ban the construction of schools on former Superfund toxic sites. Yet the current EPA school rating system is voluntary, and school districts can simply ignore it. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
The uprisings across the Middle East rage on, as well as the ongoing war in Afghanistan and the debate on the U.S. debt and budget crisis at home. But America's continued military occupation of Iraq has almost completely been absent from recent media coverage. Large protests have been occurring inside Iraq, where demonstrators have denounced government corruption and the lack of basic services such as electricity and water. Sometimes violent protests demanded the resignations of local government officials over the issues of high unemployment, repair of the electrical power grid, and a corrupt judicial system. In late February, an estimated 20 demonstrators were killed by Iraqi security forces during running street battles that also saw the burning of government offices. But the focus of protests changed on April 9th, the day which marks the 8th anniversary of the U.S. occupation of Baghdad, where tens of thousands of Iraqis demanded a complete U.S. withdrawal by December 31st, the date agreed upon by the Bush administration and the Iraqi government in 2008. A growing number of Iraqis are concerned about the recent visits to Baghdad by U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates and the Pentagon's chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, where they were negotiating to extend the time the remaining 47,000 U.S. troops now in Iraq could remain. Washington has indicated it doesn't have faith that the fragile Iraqi government can handle conflicts over oil deposits in Kirkuk and the threat of renewed al-Qaeda attacks. Powerful Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has warned that his followers will take up arms if the U.S. fails to meet the end-of-the-year troop withdrawal deadline. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Iraqi-born political analyst Raed Jarar, who explains why he believes the U.S. is playing with fire if it pursues an extension of the troop withdrawal deadline.
The protests started in Iraq as part of the protests in the entire Arab world that started in Tunisia and followed that in Egypt and other countries. So the protest in Iraq started in February 25th. That was the first day where there was an organized protest in downtown Baghdad. And most of the protests so far have been organized online, mostly on Facebook, which is really fascinating because the internet penetration in Iraq is less than 2%. So it's really fascinating to see how a very limited number of Iraqi youth are utilizing this limited internet penetration to put together tens of thousands of people in the streets to protest against the Iraqi government's corruption and demand more services. Now, the protests were mostly about these two topics, the Iraqi government's corruption and lack of services, until the first week of this month when Secretary Gates went to Iraq a couple of days before the 8th anniversary of the fall of Baghdad, which is April 9th. Secretary Gates' visit was seen as an attempt to delay or cancel the U.S. withdrawal deadline scheduled for the end of this year. So from that time, the protests have been more politicized. Most of the protesters have been talking about the U.S. occupation and the need to end all of the U.S. military occupation before the end of this year in accordance to the security agreement that was signed between the two countries in 2008 and that President Obama promised repeatedly to abide by its final deadline to bring down the number of U.S. troops to zero and the number of U.S. bases to zero before December 31st, 2011.
Raed, tell us what led to the speculation that Defense Secretary Robert Gates' visit to Iraq was somehow a prelude to an extension of the U.S. troop withdrawal deadline, which, as you said, is the end of the year.
Well, it wasn't a speculation. This is what Secretary Gates said. He said that the U.S. is withdrawing on time, but that he urges the Iraqi authorities to move quickly and request that the U.S. forces stay longer in case they were interested in that. So that was seen as an indirect way to put pressure on Iraq so that Iraq would request the extension, because legally the U.S. is not allowed to leave a single U.S. soldier, whether they were combat or non-combat forces, after the December 31st deadline, unless there is an official request by the Iraqi government that gets ratified by the Iraqi parliament. Now, this does not seem to be happening, and people did not understand why would Secretary Gates come all the way to Baghdad, meet with top officials, and urge them to think about that. It was seen as an attempt by the U.S. to prolong the occupation. Of course, Secretary Gates' visit was followed by visits by other top U.S. commanders in the Pentagon. The last one was just a couple of days ago, when Mullen went to Iraq, and he repeated the same exact message, that the U.S. is withdrawing on time, but that if Iraqis would like to change their mind within the next few weeks, that the U.S. would leave 10,000 troops on the long run, which is something that is rejected by an overwhelming majority of Iraqis. The vast majority of Iraqis want this occupation to end completely, without leaving a single U.S. soldier on Iraq's soil after the deadline that was agreed upon.
What is the rationale for leaving U.S. troops in Iraq beyond the December 31st, 2011 deadline? There are many observers who discuss the fragility of the Iraqi government and the possible reemergence of very great violence that might overtake Iraq once the U.S. troops leave. Is there any validity to these views?
I disagree with the notion that the U.S. is there to protect Iraqis from violence or to protect Iraqis from themselves. I think it is true that the Iraqi government is weak and fragile. It is true that the Iraqi armed forces are not strong enough. But these things are not despite the U.S. military occupation, but they are because of it. So while I agree that the situation is bad, I disagree on the notion that a U.S. withdrawal will make it worse. I think a U.S. withdrawal is an important first step towards fixing many of these issues in Iraq.
In your view, what will be the repercussions inside Iraq if the United States fails to honor its deadline for withdrawing all U.S. military troops? We've heard that religious leader Muqtada al-Sadr has talked about reviving his Mahdi army militia and has threatened armed resistance if the U.S. doesn't withdraw its troops from Iraq on time.
I think prolonging the U.S. occupation will be catastrophic because it will destroy what's left of faith in the Iraqi political system. I think abiding by the promises and getting out of Iraq is the right thing to do. It's the right thing politically, it's the right thing morally, and it is the right thing legally to abide by the binding security agreement.
That was Iraqi-born political analyst Riad Jarrar. Visit our website to find links to Jarrar's articles on the current situation in Iraq at btlonline.org. April 20th marked the one-year anniversary of the blowout of British Petroleum's Macondo deepwater oil well in the Gulf of Mexico, which killed 11 oil rig workers and spilled 190 million gallons of crude oil into Gulf waters and the adjoining coastline before being capped 3 months later. Since then, estimates of damage have varied, with the Obama administration claiming that most of the oil has now disappeared through recovery, evaporation, or eaten by microbes. But others assert the damage is more pervasive and ongoing. Since the British Petroleum spill, there's been a serious debate about the use of millions of gallons of chemical dispersants deployed in the ocean to break up the oil before it reached the shoreline, and its impact on the Gulf ecosystem, as well as on those who worked on recovery vessels and residents who live in the region. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Daryl Malik-Wiley, the Sierra Club's environmental justice organizer based in Louisiana. He talks about how he spent the grim one-year anniversary of the BP oil spill, the continuing disruption to the lives of the area's residents, and the formation of a new grassroots organization, Go Fish, Gulf Organized Fisheries in Solidarity and Hope, fighting to receive fair compensation from British Petroleum.
The Sierra Club and other groups did a number of events. We did a sunrise service in New Orleans down near Jackson Square on the 20th. We had a number of religious leaders and environmental leaders talking about the loss of life of the 11 men. So unfortunately, that part of the story sometimes gets left out. So we actually had a moment of silence and then the reading of the names of the 11 men who died when the BP Deepwater Horizon exploded. And so that was sunrise, and I went from there to a meeting down in Plaquemines Parish on the east side of the Mississippi River to Port of La Hache, which is a area where it's a small African-American fisherman community, mainly oyster fishermen. So they had a press conference, an event, educational event, over 80 people of a number of different fisher folk communities, Vietnamese-American, Native Americans from different tribes were at the event, and set up a new organization called Go Fish, Gulf Organized Fisheries in Solidarity and Hope. And what they're trying to do is organize and work with fishermen and fisher families for all the way from Alabama to Texas, and try and talk about, you know, the unique history, culture of the fishermen and how seriously impacted the community was by the BP explosion, and how it's still being impacted, with some people not being back to work yet, or some of the fishermen who worked in the vessels of opportunity sick. So, and then ended the day with they called it a black carpet fundraising event to help set up some free health clinics across the Gulf Coast. So that was my day. It was sort of sun up to way past sunset.
And the Vessels of Opportunity, that was what BP set up to hire local fisher folks to clean up the spill, right?
Right. That was funded by BP to hire people to go out and do cleanup work, and number of problems with it. One, the Louisiana Environmental Action Network actually purchased safety gear and gave it to a number of fishermen to wear, and respirators and things like that, because the environmental community knew about the dangers of the health impacts. And BP basically told fishermen and people who were working on Vessels of Opportunity, if they wore protective gear, they would no longer be working for BP.
Well, Daryl Malik-Wiley, you know there's been a lot of different information coming out about the impact of the oil disaster. The federal government has said it's mostly disappeared, and I know they're doing a long-term study, but the people in Go Fish are on the front lines. What do they say about the impact?
Yeah, what they say is the oil's still here. You know, we see it daily. You know, tar balls are washing up all along the Gulf Coast. Just the way the winds blow in the wintertime, the wind blows offshore, so it's blowing, you know, out into the Gulf. Summertime, we start getting southern winds blowing stuff back onshore. So we're starting to see some tar balls come in, some of the oil come in, because all the dispersant did was just put it on the bottom of the Gulf. And so we're starting to see some of that oil and dispersant coming back up and impacting a number of different coastal areas.
And the dispersant, there's a huge controversy about that, and not just between the government and BP on one side who supported it, but there are some respected experts who say it was good to use it because it kept a lot more oil from washing ashore into the sensitive wetlands. And then others are saying no one had any idea what the impact would be because it hadn't been done on such a scale before. What do folks there on the ground think?
There is still a wide range of opinion. You know, the environmental community and fishermen basically agree that the use of dispersants without the needed scientific data, you know, long-term impact of this stuff, was not a smart thing. 1.8 million gallons of dispersant into the Gulf of Mexico. Nobody's ever put that amount of dispersant any place in the world. And so we don't know what the impacts of that is going to be. Some of the people who are sick now, they've taken samples of their blood, and they're finding the chemicals that make up the dispersant in their blood, as well as Louisiana sweet crude. So, and having serious health impacts.
Like what?
Loss of memory, rashes, sinus. Some folks, you know, we've talked with, they forget where they're going. They forget who you are, you know, and these are men, all of them were fishermen, you know, so they were in relatively good physical shape, and we don't know about, you know, long-term health impact, but there's no immediate health care for folks who need it right now. And that's a big concern. People have been losing their, health insurance because they're not able to work. So that means, you know, and they don't have money to pay for independent health care. So it's just, you know, a whole range of things are happening. A number of them have lost their homes because they weren't able to work and they didn't get paid by BP like they said they were going to be. And so just it's a whole serious impact on people's lives.
That was Daryl Malik Wiley of the Sierra Club in Louisiana. Learn more about the work of the Sierra Club in the Gulf of Mexico on our website at btlonline.org. While the vast environmental and economic damage from last year's British Petroleum oil spill are still being calculated, deepwater oil drilling has now resumed in the Gulf of Mexico. Soon after the Deepwater Horizon oil spill disaster, the Obama administration's Interior Department imposed a moratorium on deepwater drilling. But under pressure from the oil industry and their conservative political allies, the moratorium was lifted in October 2010. Government officials maintained that they would not issue new deepwater drilling permits until drill platform operators demonstrated their ability to contain future oil spills. But some critics believe that the Obama administration, hoping to appease the oil industry, rushed to grant new deepwater permits without first ensuring that rigorous new safety standards were in place. In fact, a Norwegian company contracted by the U.S. government to test the effectiveness of blowout preventers used to prevent a spill in case of a wellhead explosion found that many of the blowout preventers in use today around the world have major design flaws. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Antonio Yuhas, author of the new book titled Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill, who talks about the economic and political power of the oil industry to weaken regulations on drilling safety and the widespread belief that the current spike in oil and gas prices is due to oil market manipulation and speculation.
This is, you know, hands down the wealthiest industry in the world. It's the wealthiest industry in the history of the world. Just this today and yesterday, the oil industry started releasing their profits for the first quarter of 2011, and they had a bit of a bumpy ride in 2009 after having the highest profits ever in 2008 when oil went to $150 a barrel. But they're back, and it looks like their profits are getting ready to match those of their records in 2008, and Exxon's profits increased by 50% over first quarter of last year compared to this year. And that wealth is, of course, immense. And what they did in the wake of this oil disaster was to apply that wealth in a couple of places. And one was in lobbying, and they've spent enormous and record-breaking amounts on lobbying Congress and the White House. They spent a tremendous amount of money on advertising and campaigns. And on campaigns is a very important new piece of this because, of course, in the wake of the Citizens United Supreme Court ruling, there are no more limits on how much money corporations can spend on elections and electioneering. And one of the things I found in the tyranny of oil, for example, is that what's a regular occurrence was that oil companies would spend about 11 times more money lobbying than they would on campaigns. And that's not because they care about lobbying more. It's because there were financial restrictions on campaigns. Well, now those restrictions are gone. And so we're starting to see the industry doubling, tripling the amount of money already that it was previously spending on campaigns, and that is bearing fruit such that not a single piece of legislation written in response to this disaster has become law. But they tried to isolate BP, and in addition to isolate BP, to make this look like a fluke, just a random incident. But also, you know, the Obama administration is not an oil government the way the Bush administration was. It isn't at all, and it isn't beholden economically to this industry the way the Bush administration does. But the Obama administration has unfortunately proven itself to be far from immune to the financial weight and pressure that the industry has brought to bear. every investigation that has looked into this disaster, including the president's own presidential commission on the Deepwater Horizon, has concluded that the problems that led to this disaster are systemic, they are embedded within the entire industry, and serious, serious changes need to take place. And what I conclude is, if the federal government is unable to make those serious regulatory changes, if it can't increase the skill and staff and financial capacity and regulatory oversight of its agencies, which so far it hasn't been able to, then that means we cannot do this type of drilling.
Antonio, we have seen a spike in oil prices and gas prices around this country. It's affecting the economy. It's affecting certainly everybody's pocketbooks, and it affects U.S. politics. There's a lot of pressure on the government to do more drilling because of the high price of oil and the propaganda from the oil companies telling us if we'd only let more oil wells be drilled, the price would come down, which I think has been proven quite literally to be false. But as we say goodnight, you want to discuss a bit about the price manipulation here that is alleged.
Today in the United States, we are producing more oil than we were at this time last year. Yet the price of oil and the price of gasoline are dramatically higher than they were last year. So supply has very little to do, unfortunately, with the price of oil and gasoline in the United States, although demand is higher at this point than it was at this time last year. So the fundamentals of demand and supply are not working. What is happening is that the industry is exporting more oil out of the United States than they were before, exporting more gasoline because we're consuming less, and from their perspective, we have a glut of oil in the United States. And in the world, in fact, supply has only been impacted a very small fraction due to the unrest in the Middle East. And that instead what's driving the price of oil and gasoline is speculation in the oil market and concentration and control in the gasoline and refining sector in the United States. More drilling isn't going to address any of those problems. Regulation is going to address those problems. And the last thing I would say is, we need oil to be expensive, we need gasoline to be expensive, but we need to be capturing that extra cost and investing it into the alternatives we need to get off of oil altogether.
That was Antonio Yuhas, author of the new book titled Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Read more about Antonio's book and questions about deepwater drilling safety on our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.